Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm and this is the Yacht Racing Podcast. Wherever in the world you're listening to this, I hope that you and your loved ones are staying safe from the pandemic. My guest on this episode is Danish yachtsman Nicolai Sehested, a sailor who, although he's only just reached the age of 30, has already established himself as a major figure on the international professional sailing scene. As you'll hear in the podcast, Nicolai doesn't come from a classic sailing family, but he began his competitive sailing career in Optimists before making his professional debut as a skipper on the World Match Racing Tour. From there, he leapfrogged to ocean racing with two notable round-the-world ocean race campaigns, first with Vestas and then with Team AkzoNobel, before this season joining the heady, high-octane world of the SailGP circuit as helmsman of the Danish Rockwool team. I spoke to Nicolai on Zoom from his family's farm in Denmark, where, like the rest of us, he was waiting for an end to the COVID-19 lockdown. So, Nicolai, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Let's address the elephant in the room straight away. We're recording this on April the 15th. It's the middle of the COVID global pandemic. I don't think either of us thought we would ever be doing an interview in these circumstances. I'm in lockdown here in Mallorca in Spain and have been for several weeks. How's it affecting you? Where are you and how are you coping with it?
Yeah, and yeah, thanks for having me, Justin, first of all. But yeah, I mean, I'm back in Denmark, same as you, in lockdown. Been that for 6 weeks now, and it's very tricky times, to be honest. It's hard not to be able to do what we love doing and what we normally do every day. But you know, that's... It goes for, I think, everyone in the world. Everyone's struggling with the same issues, and we just gotta all chip in and do the same to get through this quickly and in the best way we can.
And how has the reaction been to it in Denmark? What's the... I think different countries have had different responses and different timings. Has it been a huge impact there in terms of number of deaths and infections?
It's been a big impact for sure, you know, not as big as some of the other countries in Europe and US, who's, you know, seeing a massive impact right now, unfortunately for them. But no, we still had a very big impact here in Denmark. We were quite quick to lock down the whole country, and that has sort of limited the amount of deaths and sick people a bit, but it's still... no, we still had a big impact, and it's definitely something that's going to take a while for us to get through.
And where are you in lockdown? You're in Denmark, but you're at the family home, or...
Yep, I'm at the family farm and have been that for the whole time. It's sort of the best place to stay isolated, but also get out and do some bit of work and bit of outdoor activities. So I'm planning on staying here as long as we're in lockdown.
Are you able to go out during the day? You're able to do some exercise? You can go outside. Here, we can't do anything. We can go to the supermarket or the pharmacy, but it's one person at a time, and you know, we can't even get out for exercise. So it's a full-on lockdown.
Yeah, no, it's the same in Denmark. I mean, if we've been going out to the city, it's just been for the supermarket for shopping. But at the farm, I'm out pretty much the whole day, you know, doing exercising and work and sort of small hobby projects. So yeah, I'm lucky enough to be outside the whole day, but still not where I want to be. You know, on the water training and sailing with the guys. So it's the best I can do in these times, for sure.
So you're back on the farm, you're with your family. It's a good opportunity to just talk a little bit about your time growing up with this family and just how you got into sailing. Tell us a little bit about the family, first of all. Who else is part of that?
Yeah, so I've lived here my whole life at the family farm. I was born here, so it's always been a natural thing for me, you know, to be a part of the you know, running and working on the farm and being outside. And then as a hobby, we had a little Optimist dinghy next to the farm on the fjord, local fjord. So that was sort of, yeah, a natural way for me to spend my free time, was just playing around that. And then from there, it started being a bit more competitive, from the Optimist sailing into the Olympic dinghies and into the match racing and so on to big boat sailing. So it's been a part of my life since I can remember, the sailing. But I'm the only one in the family doing any sailing, so it's a bit of a weird one. I don't have any parents or grandparents who's keen sailors or competitors. It's just myself and my sister who's also been sailing with me, and she's surfing and kite surfing a lot. So it's just sort of her and I just been pushing the water sports in our family.
That's interesting. You didn't have any friends who sailed, or did you kind of drag anybody along on this little sailing journey, and any of your friends?
Oh, no, I think I more sort of met my friends in the sailing club, and that's sort of became my friends. You know, you I think when you do something like so many hours as I do the sailing, also as a kid, you know, I was sailing at least 5 days a week, all your friends end up being, you know, at your sailing club or at your sailing events. That's where you spend your time, and that's where you really dedicate your time. So instead of sort of moving friends into the sport, I sort of got my friends in the sport and then, you know, stuck with them. A lot of my close friends I had for as long as I can remember now, since we're sailing Optimist together. And that's sort of, I think, the good thing about having a sporting career is that you really, you know, you really get some close and strong friends because you go through a lot of different things with them, ups and downs and stuff like that. So I think that's one of the positive parts about the sporting life.
And were you one of these Opti sailors, one of these Opti youngsters who traveled on the circuit, did all that sort of stuff, and were kind of relied on their parents to take them around?
Yeah, I mean, I started, you know, as a farmer kid. You know, my dad just gave me a pair of gun boots from the shed that you used to use in the garden, and a pair of jeans. And then he said, "Go on, you got to prove yourself before we spend any money on this. I'm sure you're going to have enough of it in a week." So I spent the first 2 or 3 years sailing in Levi's jeans and gun boots. And then when I finally started winning a little bit, he gave me some proper sailing gear and a proper boat. And you know, I think that was exactly the right way to go about it for me. You sometimes see these Opti kids these days. They get all the gear and all the toys and they have no idea how to use it, and they get sick of it pretty quickly. I think I was pretty happy that I had to work for it. I had to earn my gear and my dry suit. It's for those who don't know Denmark well, it's pretty nice to have a dry suit when you're sailing in the winter, because most of the time it's ice and snow.
So, I'm sure.
I was pretty happy to have to go the tough way about it. And I think if I had any suggestions for other kids or you know, Opti sailors these days, is you know, you have to fight a little bit for it. If it comes too easy, it's you're not going to go the extra mile when you do need it when the time comes.
So did you teach yourself to sail, or were you taught to sail, or how did that happen? Because you kind of gloss over it a little bit, that you know, you started sailing and then we started winning some stuff. And
yeah, no, I started in the local sailing club, and that was, you know, just fun stuff. We were playing around and capsizing each other and stuff. But then, you know, there's also there's a class where you can compete more, and it's probably the same in all countries. We have A, B, and C classes. So when you get to the A class, it's more competitions, and that's sort of when I started, you know, touring around, mainly around Denmark to begin with. And then I, you know, won the nationals and qualified for the worlds. And then my parents and I, we start touring the world with the Optimist in the early days. And it was quite exciting for them as well, because they haven't traveled that much in their time. So that was a new way for them to travel. And I ended up probably traveling 150 days a year with the Optimist, which was pretty cool for a guy my age. And then it sort of just, you know, kept going, and then classes I joined after that with the travel and the training.
Can you remember what it was that just clicked with you about sailing? I mean, were there any other sports that were competing for your time at that point?
To be honest, I'm very competitive. So what drives me is the competition, winning. That's the main thing that drives me. It wasn't me sitting in the Optimist going, "Oh, this is fun, all my friends is here." It was me going, "Yeah, I'm going to beat them today for sure." And then once I beat them, I'm going to, you know, make sure they know I've beaten them. It's actually sort of that drive I had as a kid that made me really got into the sailing. And I didn't have any other sports, because I think, to be honest, I was just not good at other sports. If I played soccer, I wouldn't win. And then I'll just, you know, find something else that I could win in. So that's sort of the natural way for me in the sailing, was just the drive to win. That was mainly it.
And is that still the case now as an adult? Is sailing just the only sport that you really participate in? Because I know a lot of professional sailors, they play some golf, and you know, maybe they do some kite surfing and that sort of thing. But is sailing is your thing, or?
Oh, I've changed a lot, to be honest, over the years. It's I still have, you know, I still want to win, but I also have a lot more, a wider perspective on things, and I'm not as tempered anymore as I was as a kid. I could blow up as a kid if I didn't win, but now I never blow up. I rarely get angry. I'm always pretty calm, man. So I think I'm still want to win, but I more enjoy the journey now. The end result is not so important now as it was once. It's more about the process and the journey to get there with the team and with the whole challenge in front of you to get to where you want to be. I enjoy that a lot more now than the end result. For me, the end result is just a validation of all the decisions you made along the way and all the decisions you made from day one of the project. It's actually boring when you're standing there. If you're on the podium, it's more the journey that drives me now. So that changed in that way. And then it also gives me a lot of time and free mind to also enjoy other hobbies and sports, you know, like you say, cycling or kite surfing or
whatever it is, because you got to enjoy the journey, and you got to have, you know, sometimes when we do sailing now, you know, we do campaigns that takes 1 or 2 or 3 years. So you got to make sure you feel good in those years, and not, you know, you have other stuff that keeps you happy and keep you motivated. If you're only looking at the end goal, you're going to burn out before you get to the finish line. So for me, it's important to have hobbies and friends and family around that make sure that you have a good life while you're working hard to get to the end goal.
Do you ever go sailing just for fun now, just for shits and giggles, as they say?
I haven't done that for a few years, but I will actually do that at the end of this week. I've been working on a little boat I have here in Denmark on the farm to have a hobby, and that's almost finished now. So I think I'm going to launch that tomorrow and then go sailing for a little one cruise for the first time in many years.
You're allowed to do that now in Denmark.
We are allowed to, you know, go sailing as long as we're just on our own. So it's more that we can't be large groups together, and we can't be sailing in you know, competitions and sailing clubs. But when it's just me going on my own, that's fine.
Tell me a bit about this boat.
It's a little 26 footer. I'd call it a double ender because it doesn't matter if it goes forward or reverse. It's the same shape. So if you saw it, you wouldn't actually know if I'm reversing or going forward. But it's doing the same speed. It's sort of a perfect round polar, you know, diagram for the boat. It does 4 knots no matter what angle and what wind strength and what heading. So that's a very simple boat to sail. So it's more sort of a point, and then just you end up getting there eventually, but you don't really care how you get there. That's sort of the mentality you got to have with this boat. It takes a long time to go from A to B.
That's some contrast to the F50 catamarans that we're going to come on to talk to later on. And I think that boat's been in restoration mode for a little while, because I think you've told me about that boat before a few years ago.
I started, you know, doing this boat 3 or 4 years ago, and then, you know, I never had time because I was always traveling and doing different campaigns and regattas and stuff, so I never actually had time to finish. But, you know, at least some good came out of this isolation I could finish this boat finally and stop talking about it and actually sailing it. So that's sort of one of the few positive things about this period.
That's absolutely right. So Nikolai, just join the dots for me from the Optimist campaign. What you know, once you became too old for that at the age of 16, what did you move on to in terms of dinghies? And I think the first time I remember your name was on the World Match Racing Tour and Match Racing. Can you kind of draw the line in between those points?
Yeah, so right after the Optimist, I started sailing a dinghy called Europe Dinghy. It was quite big back then. It was on an Olympic program for the females when I joined it. So that was popular, and I did that for a year and a half. And then I sort of took a year of a break from sailing, and I was doing the gymnasium and needed a bit of a break after all those travel days in the dinghies and wanted to see other parts of life. And then in the gymnasium, I met, you know, I had 4 good friends with me, and we actually sat down and agreed to start a match racing team. So the 5 of us, we wanted to, you know, start sailing again, and we wanted to do some fun. So we wanted to team up. So we started match racing in the local club as well, where we also went to the gymnasium. And that was sort of the start to our match racing campaign. You know, we really enjoyed that, and we did that as a group for 5 years, where we worked our way up to the top 5 in the world ranking. And that was sort of what kicked off the whole process thing for me, where I really started to enjoy the process and not so much the end result. It was how we, you know, as 4 local boys managed to get from rake anti 100 to top 5 in the world just because we wanted, and we dedicated our time to it. That was the sort of the switch for me to get into the professional sailing and the professional teams, and then start working that path.
And how did you do that? How did you fund all of that? I mean, it sounds so simple, just that you guys put a plan together and then went and implemented it. But there's a lot to it, isn't there?
Yeah, it wasn't simple at all, to be honest. We had to learn, you know, everything from scratch. You start out thinking you know it all because you're 18 years old and you think everything is easy and you just got to do what you think is right. But you learn so much, and we had to coordinate, you know, who's in charge of what. You know, someone's got to manage the sponsors. Someone's got to manage the racing calendar, the training, the, you know, all the there's different aspects and you got to share between you. And you, that means you also learn a lot about the different aspects. And I was lucky to be involved with the sponsorship part of things. So I was, you know, going around with another friend of mine, Soren, from the team, and we were knocking doors, asking for money to support 5 local kids. And obviously that was a hard job, because we're not quite, you know, up there with Lewis Hamilton and these guys when it comes to PR and media value. Nobody knew who we were, and we had zero sort of, you know, what do you say, we didn't have any attraction sort of to mm-hmm. for the media to write stories about and to push it. So it was a hard job. So in the beginning, we were just sailing for very low budget. You know, we paid ourselves from our student money and just sailed in our old gear and all that stuff. And then eventually we start getting small sponsorships and start, you know, winning regattas. And then we landed our first sort of what I call a big sponsorship back then. You know, it wasn't a lot, but it was big for us. And that was with a local energy company. And they turned out to be our sponsors for the 6 years to follow.
What was
they
that
took
company?
Us on the World Matchweek. It started called Trevor, and then it changed names to Evie. And we had them with us for the whole time, for the rest of it. And we grew the sponsorship every year, and we ended up on the World Match Racing Tour with them as well. And they stayed with us all the way through the catamarans in the World Tour and so on. So that was sort of the first great sponsorship we did. And I really enjoyed that process working with them and keeping them happy and keeping them activated.
And what did you learn about keeping that sponsor relationship good? Because it's, you know, you hear some bad stories about sponsorship that kind of, you know, people take the money and they don't really give much of a return, but that's a short-sighted way of looking at things, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the main sort of lesson I learned is, or also that I figured out, was that it is not about us at all. We think we're athletes and we think we're important, but we're not. It's, you know, that company can go and get thousands different sort of sponsorship products, you know, other teams where they can get the same value, the same branding. It's not about, you know, it's not about just having a Facebook page where you post a photo and you think that keeps the sponsor happy. It's how you can activate them. Because if they want to be, you know, get some appearance or, you know, they just go on Instagram and they can pick the exact building in the exact city in the exact country at any time of the day. If they want to target that group, you don't do that as a sporting team. You need to activate them. You need to give them something they can't buy. So that was sort of what I learned. You know, we were doing corporate days where we took them out sailing as a company. You know, they were doing teamworks. They were working, getting on the water and the match racing boats, racing each other. We were doing public speeches. It was all about stuff that they can't just buy online. So I learned pretty quickly, it's not about us at all. It's about how we can really do something for them that keeps them happy and they get the return on value. And then you always just got to be available. You always got to be, you know, keeping their first interest in mind. It's not about, again, it's not about us. What is their first goal? What is their interest? What do they want to get out of it? And that's what you always got to work on.
That's really interesting. I guess the other question that springs to mind is, you know, you went from, you reinvented yourself as match racers and suddenly now you're on the World Match Race Tour circuit. You're up against the, you know, the professional teams that have been doing it for a little while. Was that like a baptism of fire? What were the early regattas like? I mean, you must have had some kind of crushing defeats, I reckon.
Oh, it was carnage. It was absolutely a bloodbath in the beginning. But, you know, you don't expect it because you're young and stupid and you think you can take on the top of the, you know, the leaderboard right away because you think you got something called talent, and then you join the regatta and you learn better and you get your ass kicked and then you go home and reflect on it. So we had the same beginning to the World Tour that most teams do. They come in and they think they know it all and they get, yeah, embarrassed pretty quickly. So we had, you know, the first year for us on the World Tour, I remember that pretty strongly. It was a hard defeat for us. You know, we came in with a sponsor. We had a good plan. We trained. We were ready, you know, to take on the world and show the sponsor that we are the team to follow. And then we just had loss after loss after loss. And that was also, I think, important process, an important, lesson to learn. And then we went back, trained more. We regrouped. We talked about what we need to do different. And then after that, we had some pretty good years with some good victories and championship wins. So that was pretty good.
What's the kind of the one key to match racing? Is it boat handling? Is it speed? Is it, you know, what is it to be successful?
No, I think, to be honest, it's about knowing when to fight and when just to sell your own game. It's a lot of young teams come in and they really want to fight and they really want to do aggressive pre-starts and they want to pick all the infights they can. But it's, to be honest, it's just, if you sail fast and smart, you don't need to sail against the other boat. You don't need to stay close to them. For sure, you got to be able to do it. If you get into a situation, you got to be able to press the red button that kicks the missiles off, and then you win that infight and you give them a penalty or you come out on top. But if you can avoid it, just get a clean start and just sail your own. It's like in a feet race where you pick the shifts and sail fast. That was sort of the main lesson for me. You don't always have to pick a fight, just be smart and stay away from trouble if you can.
It's a pretty appealing lifestyle, isn't it, that World Match Racing Tour and the just the match racing circuit generally, because as a young team like that, with four of you, really all you've got to do is get yourself to the events, because generally the boats are provided for you. There's no big outlay on a boat at that point.
Yeah, we were very lucky and fortunate that, but by the time we were getting to a match race scene, it was a massive scene. You know, that was where you wanted to, if you wanted to move on to the America's Cup or the ocean race, or you know, you had to sort of be on the match racing scene by then. Unfortunately, now that's changed a lot in the last few years. You know, a lot of young match racing teams, they're struggling to move on from the tour, because first of all, there isn't really a strong tour anymore, and then secondly, it's there's a lot of other opportunities out there. So we were very fortunate and very happy that we could do it, because I still think it's some of the most fun sailing you can do as a young group of guys. As you say, you just pack your backpack and you go on the road with your best friends, and then you do some fun sailing every day in different boats and different regattas, and it's a very fun lifestyle, that match racing, and I really hope it will come back strong. It looks like it's on its way back, which I really hope for all the youth sailors and keelboat interest sailors.
Yeah, and I think probably what you're alluding to is the tour took a bit of a left turn and moved into fast catamarans for a little while, but it's now back under new management, and I have regular conversations with James Pleasance, who's running that, and there are plans for that now to reemerge as one of the pillars of professional sailing now. But would you ever get back involved in it at any stage?
Absolutely. I still think it's great racing, and it might be silly to think you can learn something as a team when you're trying to improve your F50 sailing, but it's not true. You can actually learn a lot as a match racing as a team. There's a lot of communication, teamwork, understanding the stress level on board and how you work as a team under stress. So for sure, I'd be happy to come back and do some match racing if it returns in the same format it was once, you know, with all the leading up events, the qualifiers and the championship, all that, you know, that's great sort of setup it had once where the young teams had a path to follow if they wanted to end up in the top eventually. I hope it goes back there, and then we for sure want to be a part of it. I love the match racing, and I love that sort of aspect of the sailing.
The one thing I always loved about the tour was the range of boats that you would compete in. So, you know, one week you'd be racing some kind of fairly smallish sports boaty type thing, like I can't remember the name of the ones they used in the Olympics.
We had laser SB50s sometimes as well, you know, three-person boat and camera and trapeze as well sometimes in Germany. It's a lot of different boats.
And then you'd be
you're sailing the 40-foots as well.
Yeah, you'd be in a Bavaria something or other with 40-foot and accommodation down below. I just always felt that was fantastic. And when did you kind of change your crew profile for those events? You know, would you have different sailors, or would you just go at it as a team for the season?
No, we always went at it as a team. You know, we stuck together. We obviously, if we're only three-person or four-person boats, we had to rotate a little bit and pick the strongest team we thought for those boats. But we're always the five same guys, just, you know, doing the whole season together and figuring out the different boats to sail. And to be honest, for me, match racing is not really about what boat you sail. It's more about the racing format. Yeah, for sure, some things are silly. You're racing a cruising Bavaria, but to be honest, it's still, you know, it still comes up good racing, and it still comes up close, and you still got to manage that boat and manage sort of the racing style in different boats. And I think that's the key behind match racing, is it doesn't have to be impressive carbon fiber top of the line boats. If you want that, you know, you're in the ocean race or the SailGP instead, or the America's Cup. Match racing is something different. I think it's, at least for me, that's how I look at it.
And I think just before we move off the match racing, one thing that struck me years ago, I interviewed you very briefly at an event in Newport, and I think you were kind of into the quarterfinals or something. It was all quite tense, and you came back from losing the first race quite badly, and I asked you the question, how do you reset after, you know, I think you've made a mistake on the start line or something, maybe hit the start mark, and you know that race was over, and you could easily imagine your head would go down, and then you'd follow that with two defeats, and you just said, well, that's the big thing in match racing, you know win or lose, you just have to forget that race that's gone before and deal with the one that is coming up. And I was really impressed with that. Do you talk a little bit about that?
That's definitely something match racing teach you. A lot of the time we're racing, you know, first to 2 points or first to 3 points. So you could end up having to race five races to move on to the quarters or the semis or the finals. So it's you can't get too hung up in defeats and wins. You just got to take one race at a time, and it doesn't matter if you're down 0-2, you still got to win three races. And that's how I always look at it. We just got to win three races. It doesn't matter when we do it, we just got to do it. And I think in the beginning, if you're behind 0-2, that's a lot of time as a young team, you get broken by that. It's a hard situation to face. You know that you cannot lose one of the next three races. And that's sometimes it really get into the minds of young teams. But when you've done it for a bit and you learn to deal with that pressure and you learn to, and you see actually the positive outcome sometimes, you got to see it to believe it, that you can actually win three in a row if you get the formula right, then racing from then on gets a lot easier, because every time you're in a big situation, you know, it doesn't have to be match racing. It can be any boat or any, you know, even now with the CLGP, anytime you're in front of a big race, for example, my first race in Sydney was a big one. You know, I could have been a lot really nervous, but I wasn't, because we've been in these situations before. You know, where you just got to do the job. You got to get on with it. You can't think too much. You just got to remember the key points to get a good race in that boat you're in, and then just go do it. Don't think too, overthink it too much, and don't think too much what can go wrong. Just do what you got to do, and remember your learnings from all the years of training and competing.
So you made this move from match racing into what I think is just almost completely different. It's like a complete paradigm shift into ocean racing, into the Volvo Ocean Race, and you've done two ocean races now. How on earth did that come about? Was that something you always wanted to do, or were you approached, or how did that happen?
To be honest, I didn't really think I've ever had the chance to do it. I've never done much offshore sailing. I haven't been, you know, and Denmark in general hasn't really been an offshore nation. We sort of like it in safe fjords and channels, and with the cold beer in the boats. That's sort of a Danish mentality. So I never, you know, I dreamt of it, but I never thought it was possible. But then I got, you know, lucky enough to race with Chris Nicholson on a Japanese team. He was the tactician, and I was just a nipper. And I spent a bit of time with him on that boat. And eventually he was kind and believed not enough in me. So he gave me the chance to join him for the first, my ocean race with him. And that was a massive chance, of course. So I didn't think twice to say yes to that. I still don't know why he took the chance with me. That was, you know, so green. I had to learn so much. It was a massive chance he took. And it could have gone horribly wrong for him, you know, having a 23-year-old blonde head running around. But I thought it went all right. I'm not sure what he would say if you ask him. But I was really happy and on about that chance. And, you know, there was no other person I'd rather learn from than Chris. You know, he's done 6 or 7 races now. I've stopped counting. But he just gave me a shortcut to learning the ocean race the best way. Instead of spending 10 years of different, you know, smaller teams where you learn a few good things and a few bad things, it was just do what he does with, you know, he also had guys like Robert Salthaus and Tony Ray on board. And, you know, if you're around these guys day in and day out for a few months, you end up learning a lot of good stuff, and you end up learning it the right way to begin with, and you don't have to make too many mistakes. So that was sort of my way into it. I'd probably say I was a bit lucky that I got to sail with him and he gave me the chance, but you also got to be lucky sometimes in sport to get where you want to be. It's not always just hard work. You also got to be at the right time and the right place. That was my way into it. And then I did the second one as well with Chris. He was also on board Axonobel with me. So we've done a few miles together now.
Yeah, you certainly have. And I just want to touch on the kind of horrific experience you had during that first race. I don't want to dwell on it too much, but obviously the crash on Vestas in the Indian Ocean into a reef. Kind of a navigational error, but you guys ended up having to abandon the boat. It made huge headlines at the time, and it was, you know, I think everybody felt, you know, first relief that you guys were all okay, and then second, you know, just the disappointment you must have had. But the thing I remember most about that was the cleanup operation that you guys went through afterwards. And I remember being singularly impressed by the fact that you didn't just kind of pull the ripcord and say, I want off this island and, you know, somebody else can deal with this. The crew basically stripped that boat down and left as little a mark on the environment as possible. What do you remember about that time?
To be honest, I don't really mind talking about this, because I think all these situations, you know, not that we have many of these sort of at this size, but all situations where things go against you and things really go bad, it's a part of it. And you really learn so much from it. And it's not a cliche. You learn more from your failures than you do from your winnings. I'm only 30 years old, but I have a lot of failures and a lot of setbacks in my life. And it's the stuff I learned the most from. and it really helps you for the future. But yeah, it's it comes back to what I said earlier with, you know, Salty and Chris and Trey learning it the right way from the beginning. These guys, is there's only one way to do it, and that's the right way. It's never shortcuts. There's never, you know, maybe we can outsmart ourselves. It's just do it the right way, do it once, do it right. And that's sort of the mentality they always put into us. And there's never questions about should we just get out of here and go home. It was always, okay, how do we get on from here now? This happened. What do we do to get to the next stage? And what do we do from then to get to the next stage? It was always small goals, but we had to reach them to end up back at the start line in that race. And yeah, it was actually, it looked really, really bad, you know, when you see it from the onboard video and you saw it from the outside. But, and for sure, it was stressful that night. But on board, it was actually more calm than you could imagine. It was very clear commands, very structured, very also safe, despite the situation we're in. And that meant, you know, everyone got out of there in one piece. And same with the boat afterwards. We got that back and salvaged it and rebuilt it. So it just comes back to, I keep saying it again, the right decisions from day one, and don't take any shortcuts, and you sort of end up where you want to be if you just do the right thing every time you have the option of choosing.
You told me a story about that time in the race, because you had that crash on the boat. As you say, you got the boat eventually back to Europe, and the boat was being repaired, and eventually you re-entered the race at the end. It was a bit of a symbolic thing that I think everybody appreciated. But you told me a story about the impact of dealing with the pressure of all of that, and how back in the real world sometimes it doesn't kind of gel. And that was that you were driving to the gym one morning, had a crash in your car, but didn't want to disappoint Chris and be late for the gym, so you kind of just abandoned the car and went to the gym. Had to do press ups for Chris because you were a few minutes late, and then only afterwards did you explain that you'd had the accident. Did I get that right?
Almost. It was Peter Vibro, another Dane friend of mine. Him and I were in a taxi to the gym in the morning in Portugal, and then the taxi driver was going pretty quick, and he had the sun in his eye. He drove straight into a pillar and did a full stop with, you know, completely totaled the car, and we hurt ourselves a little bit. But then we're both scared of being late to the gym, because we don't, you know, you don't do that on that team. You stick to your plans and you stick to your agreements. So we made sure the taxi driver was all right, and he got in the ambulance, and then we ran to the gym instead. And then when we got to the gym, we said, oh, we're sorry we're late, but we're in a car accident. And the guys were like, yeah, whatever, do your push-ups, you're 5 minutes late. And it's like, okay, whatever, we did the push-ups. And then we walked back, and they could see the car was total, you know, 500 meters from the gym. And they're like, okay, fair enough, we believe you now, and let's get on with it. That was sort of mentality on that team, and always sailing with these guys. And I really like that. Not that you should not be smart, but we are, you know, people know that if you do say you're going to do something, you're going to do it. And that's a very, I think, important mentality to have when you do an ocean race.
I think the other thing I always think about the ocean race sailors is just how kind of level they are. They don't have any big highs, they don't have any big lows, and that's part of the coping mechanism, isn't it, for when you're at sea and you're having to deal with the pressures of racing a boat across the ocean.
Yeah, for sure. You have to really flat rate your emotions, because every day every 4 hours you get skets, you know, if you're doing, or is it 6 hours, I can't remember anymore, but if you're doing good or bad. And if you have a good sket, you can't get too happy, because the next sket's probably going to be bad, and vice versa. Same goes, you know, if you have a good day, you're leading the fleet. We all know that it only takes one bad breakdown on the boat in the middle of the night and you're completely last in the fleet. So you really learn not to get carried away with your emotions and just do your job, and don't get happy when it goes well, and don't get sad when things goes against you, because it will. And it's just a matter of time when the next shit's going to hit you. It will hit you. That's 100% sure when you do the ocean race. And I think that's also what happened to us in the taxi. We're so much into this race and so much into this mentality that, yeah, we both just smashed our head against the roof because we hit a car accident. But, you know, that was just a normal day, right? Because we're in the ocean race, and that also happens in the bow sometimes. So now what? Now we just got to get the job done and we'll deal with it afterwards. So it's, if that happened today, you know, in a taxi, I'd probably spend 2 or 3 days in bed trying to feel sorry for myself. But you're just in a different mind game when you are in that race, and that's sort of just to protect yourself and the team, that you're turned into this sort of machine.
That's great. That's a great answer. Thanks for that. So another Volvo Ocean race with Axel and Abel. It started off a little
little strangely, we worked together on that campaign. I was the communications person on the team. I think everybody remembers the incident with skippers being fired and reinstated and all of that. We were the story of the month at that point. And I remember you played a key role in just keeping the whole thing together, because that had the potential for the whole thing to fall apart at one point, for sure. In fact, at several points, even before the race had started. And it stabilized and you know, we got through that race and the team ended up breaking a 24-hour distance record by the end. But was that some sort of satisfaction and vindication for that difficult start?
I think it also comes back to what I said before, that, you know, you really learn more from your failures and your difficulties than you do from your victories. You know, learn always just to keep your head down. Things will change. Brighter days will come. It's I know you keep saying that and you keep telling that, and people don't always believe it because everyone just say that. But it actually true. I keep telling myself, in most bad days in the ocean race, that the sun will always rise again. Just, you know, to stick with it for a few miles, and then things will get better. And that's not quite the same situation when you're on shore in Alicante trying to get the team together. But it's sort of the mentality that, yeah, it's easy to throw in the towel and give up and just walk away, because everything you work for a year and a half has just turned to a complete disaster within 24 hours of the start of the race. So the easiest thing would have been just to walk away from it and be upset and disappointed. But no, the best way was just to get back on the boat. And I didn't really know how many we're going to be on the boat for the start of leg one. I was hoping that we're going to be more than five, otherwise it would have been long leg. But yeah, and we luckily were, I think, seven or eight on that leg. So we were able to complete it and also, I think, get a fourth. So it wasn't a disaster, but it just, yeah, it's the same thing. Don't get too emotional. We didn't get too emotional either. Most of us, we of course, we're frustrated. You have to be frustrated when your dream is turning into a bit of a nightmare, but it's still a difficult situation. You got to solve the best way you can, and the only way to solve that situation was to make sure we had a crew for the start of the race. And that's how you got to sit down as a team and try to talk everyone into be on the start line on a day, even though a lot of people feel they've been, you know, hurt a lot, which they were, but doesn't change the fact we still got to complete and finish this race, and we still got to get on with the job if you want to at least have a race team to you know, in the later in the race.
Well, we're going to move on to SailGP in a second. Just one last question on the ocean race. You've done two laps of the world now. There was a lot of talk about you doing a third one before the SailGP thing started up. I know we're in uncertain times now, but from your own point of view, is another Volvo Ocean Race, or sorry, another ocean race, a possibility for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Never say never. I really enjoy the race. I really enjoy that challenge it is, and all the, you know, all the guys that I'm really close friends with is a part of that race. Most of them. So I really enjoy that part of it. So for sure, if I have the opportunity later in life, I think I'd be really happy to take it. But for now, I'm very happy in the situation I'm in now with the F50 and the CLGP. It's probably the biggest challenge I've ever had in my life right now in the sporting side of things. And I really enjoy that and you know, working on making this a success. And CLGP is in a very strong position and it's growing every day. And the racing gets cooler and better and more fun. So for now, this is where I'm going to be putting all my time and effort in.
How did it all come about, this partnership with Rockwool and the entry into the circuit?
So our team manager Jonas Christensen, he's been working on this for many years now. It's not many, but at least 2 years since LGP started. And he came to me pretty early and asked if I wanted to be a part of it. And I said, absolutely. I mean, it's the fastest boats, it's the best sailors in the world. Of course, if I ever get the opportunity to be there, I'll take it in a heartbeat. So he chipped away on it, and then I ended up helping a bit more in the end, trying to see if we can get the funding for it. And some of the, you know, we were very lucky and very happy to get a sponsor like Rockwool. It's the perfect match and perfect fit for a Danish team. Strong sustainability profile, red and white Danish colors, and just very, you know, great people who are supportive. They don't look at this as much as a sponsorship. They look at, you know, they're in the same boat with us. So whenever we have trouble or issues, they're always in the boat fighting these troubles with us. And that's the best sponsor you can ask for. And I knew these guys, some of the guys from other sailing events, also the ocean race. We had work with them, or I have worked with them in the past. So that was an easy choice for me to when that opportunity came, that was the right decision for me to be a part of this.
It's a fantastic opportunity. I personally was delighted when I saw you were involved in the whole thing. What I'm interested in is yet again, here you are, you make this paradigm shift from Volvo Ocean Race boats racing around the world to these incredible flying supercharged catamarans. How did you prepare yourself mentally and physically and just get the skills that were needed to take the wheel of one of these things?
To be honest, I don't have the skills yet that's needed to do well in these F50s. That's a process and that's a learning process that I really enjoy to be a part of. The challenge itself was, the first challenge is to put together the right team of mainly Danish sailors. We're allowed to have one foreigner, so we have Tom Johnson that I did the first Vestas campaign with, so I know him really well as well. But the first challenge is, get the right people together, because at the end of the day, the most important thing is that you have the right team. Without the right team, you can't do anything. So that was the sort of the challenge that I thought was maybe a bit easy, actually, because I spent a lot of time doing that in other sort of sailing campaigns. It's hitting the right people and see when they're good and when they're bad. It's you really see the true people when you put them under pressure and they got to deliver. And that's something you also learn in the ocean race. You can see through the sort of the face they put on when they want to put it on. So I enjoy that process, and I think we have a great team now on the Rockwool Sail GP Denmark team. So then we come back to the sort of the sailing skills and what's needed to perform on the Sail GP, and that's something that's an ongoing process for us. We got to work better as a team. We got to get to know the boats better, sail them faster, sail them more on the limit. And the challenge is not so much right now us doing the tactics around the race course. It's more sailing the boat at 100% all the time. Because if you're fast and you can do all the maneuvers you want, the tactics become a lot easier, because then you can choose A instead of B. And that's our challenge right now. So we're going to work hard this year on sailing as much as we can together and just, getting to understand these boats and the setup of them, so we can sail them on the limit all the time instead of sailing them at 90% where they're a bit more safe.
So you are limited, I think, under the event rules, you're limited in the amount of time you can spend on the boat. So have you spent a lot of time on the simulator?
No, we haven't actually. And we're probably not going to do that for a while now, because there is, these isolation, and we are turning down the team activities just to get through these times and to save some cost as well. So we are not going to spend too much time on the simulator in the next few months, if any at all. But we are working on when we are allowed to go sailing again and how we can actually spend some time together as a team. That's something we want to really prioritize. So that's the process going on right now in these times, is planning ahead and trying to make the most and the best of this year, even though it's a very tricky and difficult year. We still got to be better than we were when we come back. No matter how long of a break we have, we have to perform better. Otherwise, we're not going to catch up with the other guys. So we are putting a lot of time into debriefing and looking at data and video from Sydney race, and then just writing all the things down while they're fresh, and we can remember. We don't know when we're going to be back on the boat again.
Are you doing that obviously remotely? You're talking to each other regularly online, are you?
Yeah, we have meetings and debriefs online every week. So it's a lot of time, and it also is good because we spend time together and we get to know each other even more than we thought we did before. And when you put a team together, you got to have different personalities. If you have six people with the same personality, it's not going to go super well for you. You're going to be best friends and everything is great, but no one's challenging you because you all think you want to do it the same, or you're all happy to do it the same way. So what we have with our team is we have different ways of doing things. We have, most people know Rasmus Kustner. He's very strong on the data and the numbers and very hard working guy, which is perfect because he's always challenging me to research more, work harder, keep looking for the things that we might not find if we just sail. And also Tom is a bit more relaxed. He's very talented, very fast, natural sailor. So he's giving the answers when we're on the boat, what he feels and what he knows from the experience with the cup. And that's also great value to the team. Three grinders is probably the hardest workers people I know in my sailing sort of career, and especially in Denmark. So we have, very lucky and fortunate to have them. They are hardworking. They're the earliest one in the morning on the boat, before anyone else, and they're the last one to leave. So they know the boat in and out. They know how to set it up fast, and they're also developing every day with sort of their inputs on the technique as well. They're not just grinders, as some people sometimes say. They're actually really, really good sailors, really talented sailors, who's also doing muff sailing with us in between events, and they have a lot of inputs for setting up the boat and keeping it fast.
And I just want to ask you about the experience of taking the wheel of one of these F50s, because you've joined a very elite bunch of people. There aren't going to be very many people in the world who are ever going to steer one of these boats. Can you just describe what it's like when the boat pops up on foils and accelerates?
Oh, it's an amazing feeling, to be honest. I think it's a mix of joy and fun, but also a bit of a nervous, sort of scared moment. The first time you really go fast on these boats, it's incredible machines. They're like, yeah, when you're sailing close to 100 kilometers an hour on the water, it's like driving in the middle of the night on the highway, you know, with you're not quite sure what's coming in front of you because you haven't done it before, but you just know it's going to be, you know, full on. So it's incredible fun, and I wish that everyone could try it just at least for a few minutes. It's very cool.
Yeah, I think you're very lucky to have that experience. And just tell me a little bit about the welcome that you've had into the fleet. Was it a welcome from, I mean, you probably know a lot of the guys that you're competing against anyway, but were people welcoming you with open arms, or was there a little bit of like, who are these guys now?
No, I think everyone's very friendly and welcoming. It's you know, it's, I think when you're at the top of most sports, I think people are past the sort of the drama and the you know, stick to ourselves sort of mentality. Everyone's quite professional. Of course, they're not going to give us the setup and the data right away, but they're very helpful. And I think most teams has been giving us tricks and tips how to get up to speed quickly. Everyone wants the same thing. You know, everyone wants the officers, you know, the teams to be close. They want to be tight racing and all teams up to speed. So we're all working to achieve the same goal. And the more, you know, the better people are and the more experienced and skilled they are, I think they're also more the helpful they are. That's sort of my experience in the sport. It's a very welcoming and open fleet, and everyone's pretty nice to each other.
And that first regatta down in Sydney, there was a bit of crash and burn in all of that. I was not too surprised to see you in the thick of it straight away. There was no staying away from the fleet. Talk us through the little bumper cars incident.
We had a small bump only, actually. But we were sitting still, and we had a small hit with Japan, but we weren't actually moving that fast. I think we're doing 3 or 4 knots, so it wasn't a big one, but it was a small low tap. But other than that, I think we sort of stayed out of trouble. But the whole plan for us was to stay out of trouble. We weren't gonna pick the infights. We weren't gonna damage the boat or the team. The main priority for us was to sail as fast and do as good result as we could, but also make sure we're in it for the whole weekend, and so we have a lot of time on the water. We can have a lot of learnings we can bring with us. The worst thing we could do was go out on Friday and just destroy the boat and race one, and that would be it. So we were holding back a little bit in some situations, but I think that's in the long run, I think that's going to pay off, to be a little bit smart and again build a strong process and not, you know, worry too much about the result right now. Just build a strong and healthy fundament, and then have something to you know, keep adding on and keep learning. I say this a lot, but it's very easy to lose all your confidence on a boat like this, but it takes a long time to build it. So we're just going to hopefully keep adding and not have a massive crash or massive issues where all our confidence and all our sort of experience gets stripped away from us. That's the worst thing we can do as a new team. We got to take our time and not cut corners and do the right decisions. And from day one, that's how we're going to end up with a good result in the end.
And all of this, of course, is subject to the pandemic allowing us all to return to some sort of normality and for events like SailGP to restart. What are you hearing from the event organisers? I know it's difficult. They probably just have a watching brief on the whole thing at the moment.
I mean, we don't hear much, you know, else than anyone else in this world right now. I don't think anyone knows how long this is going to take and how. I think everyone knows it's going to be a massive thing for the whole world, but I don't think anyone knows how much and how long before we're through it. So for now, New York and San Francisco is cancelled, of course, which is the only right option. But nothing else has been decided at this stage. So we're all sitting and watching and monitoring the situation, and hopefully we start seeing some better numbers around the world and a sort of a drop in the corona cases, but it's I think it's tricky for everyone because you gotta remember that you might go well in Denmark, you know, so you could say, oh, the Danish event is no problem at all, but we have a lot of foreigners in the whole, you know, organization from US, also from China and around the world. So it's not that easy. It's not that simple. We are global, you know, event, same as pretty much any other company in the world right now. It's very global. So we all gotta do the same amount. You can't just start opening up and racing in a few countries and then you leave, you know, half of the fleet out of it. That doesn't work that way. So we gotta stay in the same boat and fight this together.
You've had conversations with the sponsor. I guess they're dealing with it from a business point of view as well. What have they told you?
Yeah, say again, you know, Rockwool is I've never met a company that's that generous and that supportive to their employees. They're not firing anyone. They're, you know, keeping their employees. They're working through this crisis together and supporting all their staff, and they're doing the same with us. You know, they're telling us, look, we're going to get you through this. Don't worry. We'll stand behind you and we'll make sure you come out strong on the other side of it. So the whole sailing team is very happy with that and the whole team, and very calm and sort of we have full confidence in Rockwool. We'll keep supporting us and keep helping us through this. So we're happy and we can keep working and look forward and keep, you know, working on how we can become faster and a better team. We don't have to stay awake all night thinking of if we can actually come back.
That's great to hear. And I guess the one, from my point of view, the one upside of everybody being confined to their homes for the pandemic is that people like yourself get the time to do interviews like this with me. So I've really enjoyed the chat, Nikolai, as always. Thanks a million for coming on, and the best of luck with the season and with everything else you do.
Thanks a lot, Justin. And anytime, very happy to do it. It's always a pleasure speaking with you.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. My thanks again to Nikolai Sehested for joining me, and thanks also to all of you for listening wherever you are around the world. I'll be back soon with another interview, but until then, I'll just say, stay safe, everyone.